Subcommittee on Healthcare Access of the House Committee on Healthcare to order. First of all, I do want to announce, and I'm sorry if anybody was inconvenienced by this, that the work session on 2348 is being carried over until Monday. Our poor colleagues in the Legislative Council's office are swamped like mad, and they couldn't get the amendments ready. They will have them ready on Monday. So I certainly hope you didn't come from far abroad to attend that work. I'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2493. Would you just tell us a little bit about that bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the subcommittee, House Bill 2493 is at the request of Representative Greenleaf, and it requires the Oregon Health and Science University to include information on the full cost of educating students at OHSU and provide the percentage of that cost, which is provided by state funding if the Legislative Assembly approves that funding request. This does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means once it moves from our subcommittee and full committee.
And we have some invited testimony, and we may or may not have any other testimony, but can my kind colleague from OHSU and whatever hanger on her she wants to bring along with her.
Chairman Greenleaf, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Leslie Halleck. I'm the provost at OHSU, and Patrick Frengel, the so-called hanger-oner, the fiscal analyst in our fiscal services that has been kind of the engineer behind the capitation model that we've developed over the last 4 years. So I thought he was the appropriate expertise to have at my side during this discussion. As was heard a moment ago, this bill addresses a very important issue for OHSU, which is the cost of educating healthcare providers. And so what I've given you, and I apologize for the size, I admit that this was kind of a put together somewhat hurriedly. We begin our Ways and Means shortly, and we're in the middle of putting that together, and many of these slides will actually be updated by Monday for the Ways and Means deadline, and we'll give you a new version with larger type at that time. But what I've done here is try to put this in the context of how we fund education, how we actually would go about doing this if this bill were passed, to give you a little bit of a feel for some of the variables in funding healthcare workforce education. So what does it cost to educate a student, and how is that funded in the OHSU environment? And before I do that, I'm sorry.
Professor Halleck, you may notice me shutting off my cell phone, and I wish others of you would follow that that advice, because cell phones, even on silence, confuse the recording system. So, excuse me.
Thank you. What I've done here is I have inserted just a few slides, which I'll whip through very quickly, or we can skip, that just set the context for training healthcare workforce. And I think you've all heard a good bit of this, but I'm not sure. If you go to the first slide, this is the classic now demographic slide that I suspect you've seen in various formats, but it's what keeps us awake at night. That blue represents people over 65, and at 2005, we're at the very beginning of that very steep upslope, which is, of course, the baby boomers. And the next slide shows why we're worried about that. This slide shows the number of days you spend as an inpatient per 1,000 population. So it's not you as one person, but for every 1,000 people, the number of days of inpatient care that are required as a function, or utilized as a function of age. And if you look at the bottom graph, right where 65 occurs, is where that starts to swing upward. So you essentially have to take these two graphs together to see the need for healthcare providers that is coming in the next slide shows outpatient really the same story, that you use more doctor's office visits as you get older. Next slide. The shortages in the nursing workforce to deal with this coming need have been discussed in this building for several sessions now, but much less attention has been paid in testimony to physicians and dentists. And we have begun to bring that forward in the last session, but we feel that in 10 years, this state and many others will be in an absolute crisis mode, facing shortages of physicians, shortages of dentists, and many other healthcare providers. The reasons for that are numerous. One is that the production of physicians and dentists in this country has been relatively flat for 30 years, in spite of growths in the population, aging of the population, aging of the workers, the physicians, nurses, and dentists are baby boomers too, and in spite of the fact that the educational model is really not that flexible and not that efficient. If you think about it, it's an apprenticeship model for the most part, which means there's very high faculty to student ratios. There's a lot of one-on-one teaching that goes on, and that hasn't changed very much in decades. So the last two items are not the subject of this presentation, but I'm sure they're things that you are looking at. I put them here just as a context because, of course, if there are shortages of the people providing the care, that is also a cost driver.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Please. Representative Mark.
The Dartmouth Health Atlas, which, are you familiar with that tool?
A little bit.
Well, they've put out a paper, and this is from memory, that basically says that the United States doesn't need to increase the number of physicians. And so it's an antagonistic position to what you're suggesting. Are you familiar with that kind of?
Not in detail, no. There were projections like that were really prevalent about a decade ago that took into account a lot of assumptions around managed care that would result in the need for far fewer physicians. That has not played out, and this AAMC for years remained silent on this subject, partly as a result.
That's the Association of
The American Association of Medical Colleges, which had done a great deal of research on sort of the need and the distribution of physicians. And what happened about 18 months ago is that the accumulation of a great deal of analysis led them to conclude that there was a dire need for the medical education community to increase by 15%. Within 4 months, they increased that to 30% because of their analysis of the rate of physicians leaving the workforce or reducing their efforts and the production rate, which later in here I'll show you has been flat for 30 years. So I think what was built in, and I'd have to get back to you specifically on that study, but what was built into a lot of studies that have been described were assumptions about a change in the healthcare model that just did not happen.
Okay.
That's my understanding. The other thing that we face in Oregon and in several states that have significant geography, significant square footage in rural areas is a distribution problem. The physicians are concentrated in the urban areas for the most part, as are dentists and to a great extent other healthcare workers. And so it's both a quantity problem but also a location problem. And the other thing that's happened, and I think you're all well aware of this, is over the last 20 years, there have been significant reductions in state support to the higher ed system and to OHSU. The corollary to that is tuition has increased. And so students graduate with an average of a physician, for example, $140,000 in debt. I call it a mortgage without a house because they end up with a very big monthly payment, but they don't actually have it doesn't do anything except, of course, provide their education. What that does relevant to this discussion is forces them to choose professions that will actually earn a living sufficient to make those payments, and sometimes that means they can't choose a primary care discipline or an underserved practice. So the debt load of the graduates is a very significant variable that we have to address. And I put a few slides in here, and I'm not going to go through them, that describe OHSU, primarily because I want them there for your reference. And here, let me just play with this here, Patrick. And that talks about the formation of the public corporation, but the reason I did this is to show you a little bit about the revenue streams that ultimately fund education. When we became a public corporation...
If I may.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Now, I think it is important to make the distinction that OHSU is a public corporation and is a state university. It is not a private university. We hear a lot about that, and I think that's an important distinction.
Thank you, Chairman Greenlink. The reason I put this in here, I will elaborate a little bit. Until 1995, OHSU was one of the eight universities in the higher ed system. In 1995, Senate Bill 2 was passed, which was enabling legislation to form a public corporation. The OHSU retained its public mission in that legislation, and ended up in an entity that looks a lot like many public entities. It could be a school district, it could be TriMet, it could be the University of California system. They all have very similar traits. It's a public entity, has its own governing board, appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate, much as the OUS board is and many other boards in this state. But we had the ability to have our own policies, essentially be responsible for our own debt, and we took all our debt with us in this transition. But we retained our public missions. And so what that did is it enabled us to operate the health system in a more business-like manner. And if you look at the middle of this slide where it's relatively flat, that's about 1995, and I think you can see that once the public corporation was formed, the revenue of the university in both the clinical and the research, and you can't really see that broken down very well here, increased dramatically. And we've grown. We have now 12,000 employees, which is a very strong economic driver. And there's a slide in there. If you want to look at the various aspects of that growth, you can see that here. But we retained the same mission: education, research, healthcare delivery, and outreach of all three of those missions statewide. Delivery of all three of those missions to improve access to all three: education, research, and community service. Now, why am I making such a point of that? Well, during the same period of time, the state revenue that supports OHSU has declined. And in this slide, the blue represents the support to the university, the education missions, the subject of this bill. The yellow represents the hospital funding from the state. The white band in the middle is funding to the CDRC, the Child Development and Rehabilitation Center. And that little yellow blip that's in the last biennial appropriation is the Poison Center. So that's the state funding, and you saw the graph before of total revenue, I didn't leave it up there long enough probably for you to see, but if you looked at the percent of our income represented by state revenue, it has dropped precipitously from about 28% to about 3.6. So why does it matter at all that we have state revenue? Well, it matters a great deal because it supports specific things at OHSU, and first and foremost, it supports education, and that's what I'm going to be showing you in terms of the data. It also supports some other things, and that's a complexity with this bill. It supports a number of the public mission programs that deliver services statewide, such as the Area Health Education Centers, the Office of Rural Health.
Excuse me.
Sir.
Senator Richards.
The growth and change slide really went up very quickly, and the one I've got is very small, but it shows that from 1990 to 2005, the student body went up by about 40%, the number of employees doubled, and the budget went up by a factor of 600 to 700%.
Right.
So that's real interesting dynamics.
It is. And what that represents is a great deal of research and patient care that is delivered. The educational resources did not change very much, and our student body, therefore, did not grow as rapidly. The revenue from research grant dollars, and you can see that in the yellow panel there, and what isn't shown there, but is in a slide in a moment, and it kind of was in the... Actually, let me just show you this. If you look at the yellow, that's clinical revenue in the health system. I'm sorry, that's the university. The blue is clinical revenue in the health system. And so what those ratios that you just pointed out tell us is that most of the growth has been in the clinical health system and the number of patients served and in the research conducted on research grants. Neither of those increased the number of students. Now, the employee number you cite is very interesting because it says that we are doing more than per person than we were by really a fairly significant factor, and I think that's what
is that what that
shows.
I didn't know
we have that number up again.
Let's go back.
I mean, I guess that is a conclusion that can be drawn, but I assume I would have to have more evidence to know that people are doing more because you doubled the number of people.
Right. And I think what would help here, and I didn't bring, are the clinical slides that would show you the patient volumes. The patient volume increase, the number of patients served, has increased on a curve that looks a lot like that revenue curve. And so the patients served is a variable that we don't have in this slide, but that's what most of the revenue accounts for. Now,
you have an idea what proportion of that 11,500 are in that healthcare system as opposed to the university system?
Approximately 60 to 65% of those individuals are in the health system, roughly. And
could we go back to that slide then?
Certainly. This one?
Yes. Okay, thank you.
And I can bring...
Do you have what you want?
Yes. I calculated it quick in my mental math.
Can we follow up with that?
Sure, please follow up.
As an educator, what she said is that 60%, or that means 40% are dealing with education, so 40% of 11,500.
No, education and research.
Education and research, okay.
Right.
And research has been the biggest growth.
Yeah. Is that right? Let me just try to get a sense of how it breaks down.
I'm going to skip ahead here just a little bit, and I'll come back. This is the revenue pie for the current year, and it'll give you a little bit of a feel of this relative size. The red is clinical revenue, and the yellow or orange here is research revenue. There's a little bit of training-based gifts and grants, mostly grants and some contracts that are in that. And then you can see the other smaller blue and green wedges represent things like tuition revenue and the state appropriation.
As a department chair, I could tell you my experience over 10 years was my budget went from 400,000 to 8 million, and 7 million of more than 7 million to 8 million were research grants we got. The employees went from 4 employees to 35 or something.
Sure.
And the educational component of that was 4 employees, and the other 31 were research employees that were funded simply by research grants. But yet we added a master's of public health program, we added teaching at the undergraduate and at the graduate level, and I think that wasn't atypical of the experience in the institution. I couldn't figure out how to get any clinical money, however.
In that department.
Yeah.
This is another slide, and we're again slightly out of order, but it's germane to your question, Representative Richardson. This is, I call it the Pac-Man slide, which I'm afraid reveals more about my age than anything else, but this slide breaks the institution into little circles by unit. And if you look at the bottom, that big fat unit that's red is essentially the hospitals and clinics. And the Child Development Rehabilitation Center, which is just to the right of that red circle, also delivers a fair bit of patient care, and you can see that it has a fair bit of clinical revenue, that red part of that slide. Over on the right, those yellow circles are research institutes, and they are funded entirely by research grants, and so you can see that growth, and that's the component of Representative Greenlick's department that he was mentioning brought in $7 million in grants. In some cases, we organize them in research institutes where that's all they do. Now, over on the left, it gets messier, and you can see the schools over here, School of Medicine, School of Nursing, School of Dentistry, have a lot of colors. And what that means is that in a school, you may be doing all the missions. You may be delivering some patient care, you may be doing some research, you're doing some teaching, and you have revenue streams that support that are much more diverse. But if you just look kind of through squinted eyes across that, you see there's a lot more red and yellow than there is green and blue. And one of the, let me see if I, I'm afraid I'm going to have to go back here. I apologize for this. I don't see it. I'll come to it. But if you look at the, if you pull out the educational mission, and instead of doing it by schools or institutes, but rather you just say, okay, what is all patient care, what is all research, and what is all education, and how is that funded? Education is the smallest of the three by quite a bit, and it's funded in pretty equal part by tuition, state appropriation, and anything else we can cobble together, and that includes federal training grants, some, but more clinical revenue that we actually cross-subsidize the educational mission with. So it's a, the, if you take that little bit of percent of state dollars, the 3.6%, it's really between 30 and 50% of the educational programs, depending on which program. So it's a very complex institution, but the message I hope this kind of conveys is that that state appropriation is incredibly critical to the educational mission of OHSU. It's also critical to some of those outreach programs that don't have a business model that would be self-sustaining. So some of the healthcare for special kids with special healthcare needs, some of the rural outreach programs are not ones that have a revenue stream that would sustain them without that state appropriation. So,
thank you.
Probably yes, it was. Can you find that one? That this is what I just described to you with my hands waving in the air. But that upper right balloon shows the green as the state is the educational expenditures, and we have them coded so you can pull them out. And the blue is tuition revenue, so you can see the roughly equal components there. Thanks. Okay, let's go back for just a minute because this leads into sort of how we think about a capitation model of a cost per student. And let's go back to right here.
15.
Thanks. This is another version of the slide that shows the state appropriation. And the blue represents our actual appropriation in just dollars, actual dollars, uncorrected, unadjusted, just raw. The yellow shows what would have happened had there been an inflationary increase in those dollars that was equal to the consumer price index. So it gives you a little better feel for the purchasing power of the current appropriation. And to put that in another context, in this graph, the green, again, represents just simple appropriation dollars. That's what was appropriated to OHSU in the noted biennium. The yellow, again, is what the first biennium on this graph would have been had it been inflated by the CPI, by the cost of the consumer price index. And the thing I want to point out is that blue line. That blue line represents the number of students we train. And this is really related to the comment that the chair made about the number of students that had been added. In spite of that reduction, we've actually increased the number of students very dramatically. Now, what this has corrected for OGI, and what I mean by that is we have merged with the Oregon Graduate Institute. We did not include them in this slide because that would be cheating. We don't put any state appropriation money in OGI. It was a private, nonprofit graduate education institution, and as we brought it into OHSU, we do not allocate any of the state appropriation to OGI, so we haven't included them in that blue line. So that's just medicine, dentistry, and nursing students, and you can see we've managed to increase them in spite of decreasing state funds. And how have we done that? The way I just described, by leveraging the clinical revenue, the grant revenue, where there's training grant opportunities, and frankly, the transfers from the physicians.
Yeah. Yes.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, but I'm not familiar with...
Yeah, and I apologize for going through
this. So I'm trying to do is understand if there are other sources that the state is paying in where you're focusing maybe on that amount that goes toward education, but maybe the state is also paying into research, which generates, you know, a factor of additional income, which then comes back and may be subsidized as part of education, but it wouldn't have happened had the state not paid in money to it. Is that
Chairman Greenlick and Representative Richardson, that's a great question because it is a complicated set of revenue streams. There are not state dollars supporting research. I think virtually zero state dollars support research at our institution. But in terms of clinical revenue, clearly, there is clinical revenue that it helps support the educational mission, or we wouldn't be conducting it at all with these data. And that clinical revenue comes from a variety of reimbursement streams. It can come from Blue Cross Blue Shield or other third-party payers, but some of it comes from Medicare and Medicaid. And so technically, yes, there are state dollars in the Medicaid stream, but the thing that you have to factor in, and I don't have the clinical slides with me, but is that for every Medicaid patient for which we care, we actually expend more dollars than we receive. So there is money flowing into the system, but the cost for those patients is actually more than the reimbursement. So really the net answer to your question is no. There are not other state dollars other than the state appropriation. Now, there's one exception, just full disclosure. Two exceptions. Thank you. One is that there is some money for engineering that comes through a process called ETIC, which is it's really Engineering Technology Investment Committee, I think. And it's a group of industry leaders in engineering and educational institutions, and OGI was part of that before the merger. That money flows through OUS, through the OUS budget, and a little bit of it comes back to OGI. And it's about $1 million, I think, in a biennium. And so they do get some money to train engineering grads. But other than that, no. Now, the Representative Greenlick mentioned the Oregon Opportunity. In 2001, a bill was passed to allow OHSU to access bond capacity that was contemplated to be paid out of the tobacco settlement. And that bond, those bond dollars have been used to build research capacity in the institution. About half has been used in construction for research building and about half to recruit researchers to OHSU. That money's just about expended now. There's a little bit left and it's all committed and it will be expended in about 2 more years. So that was an investment out of the tobacco settlement in research infrastructure development, not in ongoing operating funds. Is that probably more than you
want? Well, I assume there's going to be payments made for the next 25 years on the
correct
funds.
Correct.
So it's about extended. You're talking about the money that was borrowed, not the satisfaction of the debt, which will
absolutely be correct.
And that's in the university's debt load?
What's that?
Is that in the university's debt load?
No, that is in the state's debt load. And actually, we have a slide that actually shows those dollars if you wanted. I didn't print it on this, but we could show it to you. Okay, let's go to the next. So who do we educate? Most of the appropriation, as I've said, supports the educational mission, and it pays about a third of the cost. We have students in a number of schools, but medicine, dentistry, and nursing is where most of the state appropriation goes. We also have, as I said, OGI. We also have joint degrees with OSU for the College of Pharmacy and with OIT for two allied health programs, the EMT, the Emergency Responder Program, and what's now called CLS, or Clinical Laboratory Science. We always call them med techs, the people who are laboratory workers. Those are both programs that we share with OIT, and it's actually a joint degree, as is pharmacy. So those are the students we support. How are they supported? I've already covered most of that. Next slide. We can skip through these because we've really already covered them. But let me just show you a little bit of a school anatomy here, just to make a couple of points. If you compare 2006 to 2000, and here I've got the school of dentistry up there, and you look at the state appropriation, I think you can see that between 2000 and 2006, the state appropriation, I apologize, the colors have switched on you here, have gone from 30 to 16%. So what that tells you is that given that, and I'm now telling you, they have not reduced their student enrollment, they are leveraging those state dollars really twice as much as they were before in the same time span. They've become more efficient, essentially, at bringing in other sources of revenue. And I have slides in there for medicine and dentistry. I think you can skip them. It's the same real point. Keep going. I want to make one point with this slide because it's an important one when it comes to capitation.
Leslie, if we just take a time check, we'll hope to run the segment in about another 15 minutes.
Okay, thanks. We'll be sure and finish up. One of the ways we've handled that reduction in the state appropriation is by increasing tuition. It's not a happy thing to do. It's certainly not something we want to do. But the alternative was not providing as much capacity to educate students or, of course, diluting quality. The point I want to make with this slide is that although tuition goes up as state appropriations go down, these are raw dollars again. There is no inflation correction. And as I showed you, our student body has essentially doubled over the same period of time. So what we've managed to do is essentially cover the increased capacity and the increases in inflation over that same period of time by leveraging and efficiency gains and not by increasing tuition. We've tried to keep this at a pretty constant just to offset those reductions. And I don't know if that made sense, but it's still not a happy conclusion, but it is there's a lot of downward pressure on our tuition rates as we try and build these models.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, please. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, looking at a slide that's not out there, but the school of medicine, for example. And so currently students are paying 2.7% of their tuition for the total cost.
No, they're paying all of their tuition. It makes up.
Their tuition makes up 2.7% of what it costs to educate them.
No, we'll come to that on the next slide. It makes up 2.8% or 7% of the total activity in the School of Medicine. And the reason it's so small is that all that green represents really research. And some clinical activity as well. And so what that tells you is that the School of Medicine, which is basically the engine for the institution, has a great number of faculty who deliver patient care and conduct research. And if you remember that slide that has the three circles, you could almost say that represents the School of Medicine, that the educational mission of the School of Medicine is a relatively small component of all the things they do.
And I don't want to take up any time other than to say other, when it's over 33%, seems like that might
A clinical, it's a bad name for that. It's really clinical activity there. So it's revenue that comes in from the clinical enterprise. Most of it is.
Thank you.
Thanks.
No, I didn't know this. No.
Okay. Go to here. The first capitation slide. Okay. Now, I don't know if you can see these numbers, and I will bring you larger print, I promise. But what I want to tell you we've done, tell you about, and I think you might probably see it better on the screen, is that we have developed a full-cost model. In fact, Patrick has developed a full-cost model along with a lot of people in our fiscal office and in our academic offices that takes all the expenditures that are incurred to educate a student. And that includes the teacher time, of course. It includes the classrooms or laboratories or simulation settings. It includes any kind of special equipment they need. In the case of dentists, they bring in all kinds of instruments, operatories. It includes all the costs associated with educating students across the institution for each cohort. Now, how you define a cohort of students becomes incredibly important and very complicated here. It's not so, what school have we got up there? Nursing's a good place to start because we have different kinds of nursing students. We have undergrads, and that's our RN pipeline that produces baccalaureate-prepared RNs. We also have advanced practice nurses, nurse practitioners, and clinical nurse specialists. Those are people that either have independent practices or practice in an intensive care unit or any number of advanced kinds of settings. And then we have academic nursing, you could say, the master's and PhD students who become teachers. They might become teachers in the community colleges or in four-year institutions. They might conduct research. So there's different kinds of nurse education going on, and they cost different amounts per student. So we divide those, and we don't divide them into complete granularity. We don't take every degree that we have and cost it out separately. That would be a lifelong mission. But what we do to understand ourselves when we want to contemplate starting or stopping a program and understand what it actually costs is we take the cohorts that seem to make the most sense in terms of having actually different costs per student. So undergraduate nurses are trained in a certain way, and so they have a specific cost. And in this case, that cost is $20,000 per student in year fiscal year 2005, the one that ended June 30th, 2005. The advanced practice nurses took a little more. That's $25,000 apiece, and the advanced doctoral prepared and masters of science nurses were $70,000. Now, why are they so much more? There's a lot more one-on-one training that goes on and a lot of advanced training that goes on. So the cohorts that you define, again, are averages of all the degrees that fit in that cohort, but they're different kinds of educational models and a lot more one-on-one training for the more advanced programs. Does that make sense? That the way you define those cohorts becomes incredibly important when you're trying to ascertain both what you want to invest in, but also how much it will take to deliver the program.
But now, the same slide for the medical school?
Yes. Keep. Go to the.
Looking at the
NPs, I mean, a substantial amount of the cost is never seen in there because a lot of that training takes place for free out in hospitals and in clinics. And so that is never captured because there is no reimbursement taking place.
That's a fantastic point. Chairman Greenlick and Representative Maurer, that's absolutely true. The way we built these models, they are OHSU's costs, but we have not included in those costs the hospital, the health system, or the clinics, even our own, let alone the community-based practices where these students sometimes rotate. Those are not included here. Now, we didn't include our own, which you might have thought we would, because those are part of things like Medicare cost reports and the reimbursement that we seek from the federal government. We didn't want to appear to be double-dipping, and in no way are we here. We also, when we get to the medicine, I'll make a similar point. Why don't you go to the next slide here. This is dentistry, and this is actually probably the simplest group to look at because most of the students in the School of Dentistry are dental students and will become dentists. We do train some residents. Most dentists come right out of dental school and go into practice. But in fact, there are residency programs, and they're relatively expensive because, again, there's a lot of one-on-one specialty.
Excuse me, yes. Dr. Richardson?
I have just in line with what you're saying, there's two or three correlated questions. One is, I see resident and non-resident, the tuition is the same. I know that we have a waiting room. I see resident and non-resident looking at total costs, and they.
Yep.
And the same thing with the nurses.
I can't explain that. Chairman Greenlink and Representative Richardson, if you look down at the tuition line down at the bottom, we probably should have used different colors. The total cost is the same because the student's a student, and they cost the same to educate whether they're a resident or a non-resident. But the way we support them is different in that they pay, here we say $28,000 per student for a non-resident and $19,000 for a resident.
Is there any preference toward applicants from Oregon?
Yes, there's a very strong preference. That's balanced by the revenue needs of the institution to manage that capacity. But for example, in the medical school, and I probably won't have time to go in it, but you do have the slides. We show the applicant pools where we have very large applicant pools in both dentistry and medicine. In both cases, your likelihood of being admitted are much, much higher. I have to know it's about fivefold in the medical school if you're a resident than if you're a non-resident. And the way that actually works is that the key to being accepted is to gain an interview. And residents are virtually, if they're qualified, virtually all have an interview. And then, of course, they're scored after that. But the competition is keen. We had 4,000 applicants for what amounted to 120 spots in the medical school this year. So a lot of students still don't get in because we're constrained by capacity. Now, what I want to show you here, if you go, I'm not sure what order. Keep going. Right, let's do the medical school. This is a similar slide for the School of Medicine, and we're still refining the numbers, which is why Patrick put the draft up there. The fiscal folks were getting after me for trying to pull these out today because they aren't quite final. But I think what you can see here is that we've divided the medical students into four cohorts. Well, there are literally dozens of cohorts in the medical school. So, again, you have to make a judgment as to how to divide those up. The medical students we pulled out for obvious reasons. People think about that. That's the crisis we think we're facing. And they have a very unique cost model. But we also have PhD and master's students in the basic sciences, the graduate students. And we have an increasingly large number of master's students that are what we call professional masters. And the Master of Public Health is a cohort that's grown relatively rapidly. We also have programs informatics, which is kind of a computer science decision making biostatistics program. Actually, a lot of synergy and overlap with some of the MPH curricula, and those graduates end up going sometimes into health fields. Some of those are students who are already healthcare providers. Some go into the health insurance industry, into a variety of sort of data management applications. And each of those costs different amounts of money. And so you can see that the medical students are $89,000 a year. They're very expensive to train. The graduate students in the professional masters are in the $30,000 to $35,000 range. So again, you really have to look at every single cohort and determine the costs separately if you're going to make sense out of the data. And you're going to be hearing, I'm not sure you personally are going to be hearing, but there will be presentations in this building the first week in March from about the entire educational enterprise that will look at costs per student. And a lot of work has gone into that, and it's actually the data is really very interesting. But even so, it's rolled up data. So when you look at the School of Medicine data in that data, you will see a cost of $68,000 per student. Well, there's no $68,000 on this slide. And that's because it's an average cost of all the students in the School of Medicine, which is a potpourri of different kinds of learners. So,
can I ask a question?
Sure, of course.
I'm having a little trouble seeing that slide, but it looks like the cost of medical education, say, $90,000.
Uh-huh.
And the in-state tuition is about 20.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Right, 19. And the out-of-state tuition is about 30.
Right, in that year, yes.
Why are we so willing to subsidize the out-of-state students at the same time?
That's a great question, Chairman Greenlee. The tuition setting for non-residents is really set according to market. We manage how many residents we can accept by what finances we have to run the medical school. But the tuition level is set at the level of privates. And it's a little higher than this now. It's about $35,000. But if you go beyond that, you are outpricing Stanford and Harvard. And so what happens is you lose students based on a very high tuition model for the very best students. So you're trying to compete in a market where you're trying to bring in students. And if you show the next slide, when we look at, this is the same data in terms of all the costs, but what we've done is we've looked at the state dollars a little differently, and this is how the OUS system has looked at capitation, because if you think about a bucket of medical students, we don't put a red dot on the residents' heads and say we're going to teach you this way and we're going to teach the non-residents that way. It's basically a budget, and we teach them all, and if you figure their cost is the same for all, what you see is that if you divide the state dollars and look at it as going across across all students, which of course is not how we look at it. That's why we have differential tuition. You can see that we contribute as a university more. We have to a gap of 40,000 per student for residents and 30,000 for non-residents. So it's really a question of balancing the books.
But if you assume that all the state money only went to residents,
back up one.
That might change that number.
Yes, it does. And we have, you know, there's 10 versions of ways to look at how the state money flows through the School of Medicine. You can assume that it's allocated according to the cost of the cohort or per student, not according to the cost, to residents, only to MD students. I mean, there it really depends on what you assume. So what we've tended to share is the version that seems to make the most intuitive sense to people, which is that it applies to residents and that it applies to the cohorts in proportion to the cost of the program. So that's how we tend to show it.
Thank you. I just want to... I'm sorry, I'm going to take a step back here in this question, and I realize this question may not pertain to the particular piece of legislation before us, but I think it does pertain to your...
Sorry, did I promote you?
Presentation.
Or demote you?
What did you call me?
I'm told I called you Senator.
Oh, wow.
Which I would assume is a demotion.
Start.
I apologize.
Thank you. So my question... You're not here, I don't think, today at least, to ask for additional state support for OHSU, but I think an undercurrent is that there's a public policy question here having to do with state support for OHSU, and I'm having trouble understanding what that sort of public policy problem is.
It's my bill. I'd be happy to explain that rather than...
Can I just clarify what I'm thinking here, which is... I certainly see from a university standpoint the challenges, or from a institutional standpoint, the challenges having to do with providing this extraordinary education given the limited state resources. But you've testified that you've increased the number of medical school students and other school students. I would assume you would testify to the strength of the program, the quality of the program. We know OHSU does as good or better job than probably any other institution in the country in terms of its education. You've kept tuition relatively flat or close to it, if I understood that slide correctly.
Why don't you go back to this slide?
But anyway,
and you've reduced the state appropriation, or the state has reduced its appropriation, which is, you know, from a public standpoint, you could say in the interest of taxpayers. So I'm just curious, what am I missing here about the overarching sort of public interest question?
Sure. Representative Cannon and Chairman Greenlake, let me just make one little clarification. Tuition hasn't been held flat. It's been increased quite steeply. And so the light green represents the total tuition revenue for the institution. I have many slides that I could share, and I'll be happy to bring you those back, that show basically the curve of tuition rates just looks almost as steep as some of the revenue.
I misunderstood this slide. I apologize. I see it now.
So
students are graduating with much more debt.
But before. To get back to your bigger question, really, we believe, and I apologize if I got lost in the trees there, we believe that we have leveraged incredibly to build as much capacity as we possibly could. But what's before the Ways and Means from OHSU is our initiatives to enhance that capacity by essentially partnering with other institutions and putting learners out into the community so we don't have to build a bigger chassis. We think that's the most cost-effective way to expand the capacity rather than build another medical school on the hill or double it, but rather to leverage other providers, and partners are very willing to do that. So to us, the public policy question, which is not the subject of this, mm-hmm. this hearing really, but it underneath this hearing is how you cost out the public policy question, is what's the most cost-effective way to graduate healthcare providers in greater number. And what we've done so far, which is what you've been hearing about, is leveraged, squeezed essentially everything we can out of this, including bringing in non-residents, partly for the revenue. The other aspect of that is, unlike most every other state, our non-resident graduates are just as likely to remain in Oregon as our residents are, and most states have quite the opposite. Two-thirds of their non-residents leave, and two-thirds of their residents stay, and ours are almost equal. So
I think we do need to end this now. And I'm sorry, I apologize that I didn't testify to begin this hearing in terms of what was on my mind when I introduced this bill. In the I mean, in the 2003 session, the governor's budget proposed $30 million or something in round numbers for the university, down from $80 million that had been proposed, that had been funded in the 2001 session. Ways and Means took up this discussion and ended up funding $62 million or some number. The budget discussions, as I heard them, and I'm sure Representative Minnis heard them, an even stronger deal, didn't make any sense to me. It was, should it be $80 million? Should it be $30 million? No, $62 million, that's a good number. It's just literally, you know, as a scientist, drove me completely crazy. There was no rhyme or reason to that. So it struck me, we are trying to find a way where we have this discussion in terms of rhyme and reason. And one model would be, all right, the state should pay X percentage, make up that number, X percentage of what it actually costs to train an Oregon student. We might extend that to say to train other students if we have other social policy. I mean, and not presupposing what that percent should be, but at least getting the data in front of us so we can have a discussion based on something that seemed a little more rational to me. So this bill is simply almost a straw man, because it appears that the university is about to start presenting data this way anyway. But what I was hoping with it, and I find this conversation very interesting, was that we could advance the discussion of how it is we ought to be supporting the development of health professionals in the state of Oregon. And that's the public policy issue behind this discussion. I do thank you for making this presentation. I find it most useful. It would be much more useful if it was in a form I could read with my trifocals.
I promise to bring you a bigger
And I suppose any of us, it would be useful if the administrator can notify us when this budget is before Ways and Means, and we could join with that discussion and listen to it. And that is basically, I really do thank you both for coming. I think your hanging around here did a great job of moving the slides. And a great job even before that. Representative Maurer, do you have a final word?
A final word, and I appreciate asking for rhyme or reason. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Greenlicht.
All right, you can have it. Well, we can all have a final word. Let's have each of us have a final word.
Yes. It's not necessarily a final word, but I know through other universities that if you reside in China or out of the United States, is your tuition cost the same or as a non-resident, or is it another step up?
Chairman Greenlicht and Representative Compton, it is a non-resident if you are an international student.
Thank you.
All I wanted to say, Mr. Chair, is that I'm pleased that we were able to double what the governor had originally proposed.
Indeed.
Yes, exactly. So was the university. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2348.
Oh, yeah.
All right, sorry. 2493, and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2517. I thank you all for coming down today. We have Representative Buckley still here.
He's here.
Yeah, I have my glasses. I just can't see with them. That's a different problem. Representative Buckley, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlicht, Vice Chair Cannon, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Peter Buckley, House District 5, South Jackson County. Thank you very much for your time and consideration today. I'm here to introduce to you House Bill 2517, the Prosthetic Parity Bill. This issue was brought to my attention by a constituent, a healthcare provider from my district, who is here to testify today. And in brief, automobile insurance, workman's compensation insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, and some private insurance policy cover prosthetics. However, a growing number of group and private insurance companies are capping the benefits so low that the average working family cannot afford a prosthetic, while other health plans are creating lifetime caps or eliminating coverage completely. Without adequate access to prosthetics, people with limb loss are unable to lead productive lives and are at risk for dangerous and costly secondary conditions such as obesity, cardiovascular disease, and additional amputation. The proposed solution would require insurance companies to cover prosthetics and orthotic devices equal to the Medicare level, a careful balance of cost, and appropriate level of coverage. It includes mandatory coverage of repairs and replacement of prosthetic and orthotic devices. It prevents insurance companies from creating annual or lifetime caps on coverage for amputees. The question of cost will be brought up, and I would just like to note information from the Amputee Coalition of America that six states, including Colorado, Massachusetts, and California, have enacted similar legislation, and legislation has been introduced in numerous other states. Based on reports from Colorado, Massachusetts, and California, the cost of the required coverage will be between 12 cents and 35 cents per member per month. And in my view, that is a cost worth paying to make sure that amputees in our state have the coverage they need. The benefits of this solution would be insurance coverage prosthetics will prevent cost shifting in the form of disability benefits to the public sector. Amputees will be able to lead more healthy, productive, and happy lives. And again, I appreciate your attention of this bill. I'd be glad to answer questions, but I'd also be glad to field them off to the folks who are personally involved in this field of care.
I have a question. Representative Buckley, does this only relate to amputees?
I'm going to probably let my colleagues answer the questions for you on that, Representative Greenick, if that's all right.
Thank you very much for testifying. We'll ask everybody and we'll find out.
Pretty great. It's very good to see you.
Appreciate you. We have a large number of folks, so I'll ask you all to say what you need to say, but keep it as brief as you can. We have a panel. Dr. Matt Brady. I'm sorry, Bradley. See, are glasses an orthotic device? Forrest Sexton and Jinji Torahara. Mr. Torahara, if I was right on.
Ginji.
Ginji, all right. Any order you want.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matthew Bradley. As Dr. Greenlick stated, I am a third-year resident up at OHSU in the field of orthopedic surgery. First off, thank you for giving me the opportunity to come down and speak on a piece of legislation that's near and dear to my heart, as I am an above-knee amputee as well as a physician and surgeon. Start off by saying, 20 years ago in 1 week, I was struck by a car driven by a person under the influence of alcohol. I spent about 3 months in a pediatric ICU undergoing about 35 various surgeries, one of which was the above-knee amputation of my right leg. After about a year of rehabilitation, visiting many surgeons and a couple revisions to my amputation, I was finally able to get a prosthetic leg and begin walking again.
How old were you at the time?
I was 10. I was 10 years old. And as a 10-year-old boy, I was very active, participating in basketball, baseball, football, chasing kids around the neighborhood. And I had this little thing ahead of me called adolescence, which meant I went from 4 foot to the 6 foot three I am now. Along the way, I had to incur the cost of many new prosthetics. I wore them out being an active kid. I outgrew them. They don't last forever. And my father was working two jobs at the time. We come from a middle class family living out in rural Indiana. And every time I needed a new prosthetic leg, Dad always had to make a quick trip to the bank to, quote-unquote, get some money. Now, I knew he worked two jobs. He was not around many nights, teaching at a local college. I knew he worked two jobs. I knew he had good insurance. So I always assumed that Dad was going to the bank to pick up the money that the insurance companies had sent to the bank. It wasn't until my teenage years when I started wising up to the whole system of what was going on. And Dad wasn't going to the bank to get money from insurance companies. He was going to the bank to refinance the house, remortgage the house, cash out his 401k retirement plans to pay for my legs. Now, Mom and Dad, I love them dearly. They never said a word. They encouraged me to continue being active. They didn't ask me to, quit playing football and quit breaking these things. They didn't put a brick on my head and ask me to not grow anymore. They just paid for the legs and went on with life. Dad continued to work two jobs, continued to pay for my legs. And I went through the rest of high school, went to a small university in Indiana called Notre Dame. Some of you have probably heard of it. And I got married right after college. Got married to a beautiful woman, and that was the end of mom and dad's support. I was now out on my own. I went to the Indiana Medical School, and after the third year, I wore out my leg. I was about 5 years old. I had great insurance. I had Blue Cross Blue Shield insurance through medical school. I figured no problem getting a leg. I'll go get fit for a new one, complete medical school, and go on to a residency. Fortunately, I found Blue Cross Blue Shield doesn't pay for prosthetic legs. The cost of them was slightly more than the federal government was willing to pay for on my Stafford loans. So it forced me to spend my afternoons calling up various charities, going to my local communities asking for donations so that I could pay for a leg and complete medical school. It was about that time that I pledged myself that when I finally grew up and became a physician, I'd set out to try and change that system. I felt that prosthetics was not a cosmetic thing. It was not anything that, you know, insurance companies should be able to say no to. I thought it was medically necessary. I didn't understand why they wouldn't pay for my leg, but they would pay for, you know, somebody with a heart attack to have a cardiac catheterization or a stent. So I eventually did get a leg donated. Vocational rehabilitation paid for a large portion of it. I completed medical school. I was very fortunate to match up here to OHSU in orthopedics, and I've spent the last 3 years working in the Division of Orthopedics. Now, Dr. Greenlech, I'm sure you can attest, as being the low man on the totem pole, you work a lot of long hours, a lot of nights, a lot of Fridays and Saturdays. In the state of Oregon, we have two Trauma One centers, OHSU and Emanuel. So all the bad traumas get funneled up through those two systems one way or another. Unfortunately for me, that means I get to interact with a lot of the bad traumas that do result in amputations. It's been a kind of a lifelong goal of mine to not let any amputee go without getting the proper care. And to me, the proper care has always meant more than just amputating a leg and getting the incision to heal. That's an easy part. Anybody, any surgeon can do that. That's not a very difficult part. The difficult part to me has always been getting these amputees back to a quality of life and back to an activity as close to what they were prior to the amputation as they could. So every amputee I have the opportunity of seeing and dealing with, I make them that promise. I make them the promise that I will be with them from the time I amputate their limb until the time they can walk into my office and say, "Doc, I'm done with you. Thank you for your help." And, you know, over the last 3 years, I've treated a fair number of amputees. Their stumps have healed. They've gone through rehabilitation. Everything's been great as far as the medical aspect. But they've come to me and they said, "You know, I'm 6 months out now. I'm ready to go back to work, but my insurance company won't pay for this. I can't afford $30,000 for a leg. So I'm on disability. I'm taking public housing. What can I do?" Well, for me, I made the promise to stick with them until they got a leg or an arm and could go back to work. And what that's meant is that's meant many of phone calls to insurance companies, many of letter writing, you know, doing what I can to try and help these people out. And yeah, I've been fairly successful over the last couple of years, but I haven't been perfect. And that always eats me. There are amputees I have not been able to help. I've not been able to get them legs through charity, through their insurance, through whatever means. And that was part of my drive for writing this legislation almost 2 years ago. And kind of bringing it to the forefront now is my goal as an amputee, as a surgeon, is to make sure that no amputee goes without the necessary prosthetic to go back to work, to become a member of society, become a taxpayer again, and live a life as normal as possible. The technology is out there. The improvements in prosthetics are there. There's a lot of studies now that show that you know, above-knee amputees can return to near the same activity they were prior to him, which means they can go back to work and the job that they were previously trained to do and pay taxes and become very good, active members of society, take care of their families. And that's really my goal for being here today, is to please ask you to consider passing of House Bill 2517 for the amputees. This is something that I had some people that helped me, helped guide me, and helped hold my hand throughout the whole process. I'm returning the favor. I promised one I'd never let them down. I'm going to give it 110% to keep that promise.
Thank you. Should we wait? Let's wait till all three of the folks have a chance to testify.
Mr. Chair, my name is Forrest Sexton. I'm from Medford, Oregon. I am an orthotist prosthetist. Yeah, exactly. Say it three times. No, in lay terms, what I do is I design, build, deliver, and train people in the utilization of orthotic and prosthetic devices. I got my start in this profession at the age of 17 in the U.S. Air Force. Did 4 years for the Air Force, got out and proceeded my civilian education. Had several years of college, did my specialized training in orthotics and prosthetics in a campus associated with the University of Tennessee. Had 2 years of residency, no, 5 years of residency after that, and now what's referred to as a certified orthotist prosthetist. I have began private practice 11 years ago in Medford, Oregon. I currently have 8 facilities throughout Southern Oregon and Northern California. I employ 35 people. I'm also today coming before you as the president of the Oregon Orthotic and Prosthetic Association. Okay. For 24 years, I've been doing this particular profession. Like I said, of the last 15, I've been involved in some capacity or another in a management or ownership of a facility that provides this care. And over that last 15 years, there's been really a disturbing trend occurring in the provision of orthotics and prosthetics. They have begun, insurance companies as a whole, private insurance companies who we're here to discuss today, have begun the process of decreasing or deleting care of orthotic and prosthetics from their plans. This is a recent survey done by the American, for the Amputee Coalition of America, indicates that 40% nationwide, 40% of the amputees in the country in the last 2 years have had either a decrease or a complete omission of their care through their private insurance company. This is a new phenomenon, as I'm saying. 3 weeks ago, a lady walked into my office in Grants Pass, Oregon. 3 days ago, a lady walked into my office in Grants Pass, Oregon. 3 weeks post-amputation surgery. She had a prescription from her physician requesting that she receive a prosthesis and consequently become trained in the use of the prosthesis and return to life. Upon looking at her insurance, Pacific Source, a fairly large insurer in Oregon, it became apparent that she had a $5,000 annual max cap on all durable medical equipment. At that point in time, she had used $3,300 of it for ancillary medical devices, walkers, wheelchairs, anything that she needed to survive while convalescing from the injury that took her leg. That left this lady with $1,700 in benefits left in DME. This lady's going to need $15,000 to $20,000 in prosthetic care over the next year to return to a normal active lifestyle. This lady left my office with the realization that she may not walk again. It's done. 2 months ago, a man walked into my office. He's been an AK amputee for 15-plus years, also in Grants Pass, Representative Maher. 15-plus years as an AK amputee. Very productive, hardworking man. He has a good job that provides his family with insurance. His insurance was Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon as a health plan. I apologize, not Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. It was Mutual of Omaha. Big difference, sorry about that. Mutual of Omaha. I'm from Omaha, by the way. Get that straight. Okay. But nonetheless, Mutual of Omaha Insurance provided for this gentleman a $5,000 a year annual deductible for prosthetic care. He had a copay beyond that point. His wife needed a major surgery, and he had to choose between his wife receiving the surgery or him receiving a new prosthesis. It should be noted that the prosthesis was ill-fitting. This guy was in great pain using the prosthesis, and the knee unit of his transfemoral or above-knee prosthesis was broken, and he was falling several times a day. He had to go without the prosthesis, making the choice to take care of his wife's knees. Every day, to this day, he does not have that prosthesis, and any fall could be the fall that makes it so he can't work anymore. Therefore, he loses insurance and his wife's health and be in danger anyway. These are two examples. The examples go across the board of what's happening, but we're seeing that the crisis in the healthcare industry and private insurance is that they are capping limits. They are providing for one prosthesis a lifetime. They are setting $1,000 and $2,000 annual maximums for prosthesis that can cost $30,000 and $40,000 a piece. And this is not coverage. Now, nobody understands this. These people don't know to complain when they buy the plan that $1,000 a year is not good coverage for prosthetics until they need one. And that's when they find out. The insurance companies, I believe, know that, and they cover their costs in this area. Now, there was a study done, Representative Buckley indicated, there's 7 states that have passed this plan. 3 of them done extensive studies in the cost of the plan. Most recent was California, passed last fall. And I have submitted a copy of their investigation, an 80-page document where they studied the cost of the plan. They indicated in their plan that this would cost less than a can of Coke. We're talking across all insurance average 14 cents per person per month to provide prosthetic and orthotic coverage equal to that of Medicare. Okay, and that's what we've tied this to is Medicare guidelines. Of that 14 cents per month per person that they're going that the health plan is going to charge for the care, 11 cents is going to be saved by the consumer that's currently paying that out of his pocket. So the overall cost is 3 cents. On top of that, there is no on top of that. On top of that, the medical report indicates that there is going to be no increased risk of utilization. Either, in other words, we're not going to have more amputees asking for legs tomorrow, secondary to passing this bill. On top of that, there is going to be no increased risk of utilization of technology. In other words, the prescription patterns of the physicians are not going to change, secondary to this bill. They're being ordered what they needed, no more, no less. Okay?
You begin to wrap up?
I'm wrapping up. 1 second. Done. It's been estimated that for every $1 of rehabilitation, for every $1 expended on rehabilitation, there's an $11 return on your money in society. I'm going to suggest that you can't begin to argue what the return is going to be by returning people to active and productive lifestyles. And I urge you to please pass House Bill 2517.
Thank you, Mr. Torihara.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Genji Torihara. I'm 27 years old, born and raised in Salem, Oregon. Currently, I'm on full federal maximum Social Security disability, Medicare, and Medicaid. In the fall of 1998, I suffered a traumatic injury, which led to the loss of my leg in May of 2000. Since then, I've undergone 35 surgeries, including a total hip replacement on the left side. When I became disabled, I was fortunate to have great private health insurance, which included Pacific Care of Oregon, Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, which was added because my parents wanted to make sure I had full coverage at the time. I'm very fortunate that my parents have been very supportive. These insurances were primary over Medicare and Medicaid at the time. The reason I'm here is to tell you an example of what I was able to accomplish during the time I was covered under private health insurance. Currently, I'm not working. I'm receiving full disability of $643 a month, and I'm on Salem Housing to help pay for the rent. This is very difficult to live on. And I feel I'm wasting a lot of my time, education, and life experiences I've undergone to meet a quality of life medically, which is covered under disability. The only way to meet the needs is to stay on disability because I lost my private health insurance when I turned 26. In the fall of 1999, after undergoing 7 surgeries, I had the opportunity to attend the Claremont Colleges. It was one of the top liberal arts colleges in the country, and I ended up with a bachelor of arts degree in music and science after 5 years. I'm a very driven person, and I have great dreams and goals, which includes being an orthopedic surgeon. I was a 5-year scholar, and I was heavily involved in student activities and political activism. Along with the student government activities, I was public relations director, treasurer, vice president for the Claremont College Republicans, which is the largest California College Republican mailing list in the state during the 5 years I was at the Claremont Colleges. This opened many doors for me. I was able to work on campaigns such as Arnold Schwarzenegger recall campaign, along with other campaigns. Working for other fundraisers, I was able to get the great opportunity to work as a liaison for the White House Press Corps during the President Bush President Bush fundraiser in Santa Monica. These great experiences, you know, has really driven me to want to pursue a life in politics, maybe locally, regionally, nationally, but also you know, it were memories and
experiences. I'm sorry, Representative Buckley.
But these also were memories and experiences that became great influence for me. Also, post-amputation, I traveled 60,000 miles a year to countries such as Japan, Italy, France, England, Germany, Singapore, and all that, even though, you know, I was going to college and being able to live what I felt was a great quality of life. I've always dreamed of being a doctor. I thought it was impossible, but then I met Dr. Bradley, who actually did one of my amputation revision. And the only way I'm able to pay for these insurances and make it through this need of medical necessity is to stay on disability. So all these experiences I learned in college, all these, you know, activities I did, I feel like I'm wasting time. You know, I feel trapped, and I have to just sit back and wait until the conditions of my disability significantly improve, as well as my medical condition. The cost of me being on disability for the rest of my life, which is a legitimate claim, would be far more than me being a productive member of society, using these skills and educations I learned to, you know, pay taxes, work, and also just from what you see in my leadership position, just be a positive asset to society. You know, the somewhere along the line, you know, we stop believing we can do anything. If we don't have our dreams, we have nothing. And, you know, I really hope you look at my example and somebody who has been through so much up to the age of 26. After that, for the last 2 years, I haven't been able to work because of the medical necessities I need. And a bill like this would help me be able to get back to work, you know, be an asset to the society rather than having government cover me and pay just to maintain a quality of life that I feel is, you know, is important. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Any questions, this panel?
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Yes, Representative.
Dr. Bradley, I want to congratulate you on your accomplishments, and certainly you're a great example, as well as your parents, who sounds like they sacrificed quite a bit. Could you tell me, over your lifetime, how many replacements you plan to have?
Mr. Chair and Representative Minnis, it's a difficult question because typically you don't replace an entire limb all at the same time. You know, as you're going through adolescence, and as you grow, you can replace components. Over the years, the prosthetic industry has gotten smart, and they've made these things kind of rebuildable, like cars. When you wear out your heater, you wear out your tires, you can just replace the tires, and that has significantly reduced the cost. So over the years, I think I figured I've had about 14 or 15 sockets, which is the thing that my stump, or my, I think the politically correct term is residual limb, fits into now. I've had about 14 or 15 of those. And as far as the other components, the knees, the feet, the pylons and stuff, you know, those have a life expectancy of somewhere between 2 and 5 years. I think I've estimated I've had about 6 or 7 different knees over the past 20, you know, years of my life. So they have become rebuildable, and the cost of not having to replace the whole thing is certainly there as the technology has gotten better and better.
So, follow up. I don't know anything about this, so I'm going to ask a few questions. If that's okay. You don't have to replace the whole limb, but is it a $30,000 expense every time you go in to be?
No, not at all. When you have to replace the whole limb, yeah, it's a $30,000 expense. But a great example, just recently, I put on a little bit of weight. And I had to get a new socket made.
So much for working hard as a resident.
80-hour work week, man. You got plenty of time. They only allow us to work 80 hours anymore. Can you believe that? So I put on a little bit of weight, which required, you know, a new socket. I hadn't had a new socket for 5 or 6 years. And the cost of that was somewhere around the $8,000 to $10,000 range.
All right.
And that's been the cost over the last 5 years.
So on an average, the lifetime, I know it depends on what age you are and that kind of thing when the injury occurs. What is the average amount or how often or how many times on average are these things, do they have to be fixed, updated?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm one person. I can tell you how many I've had. Forrest is obviously a prosthetist who sees many of these. I'll defer that to him.
Medicare currently defines the lifetime of a prosthesis as 3 years.
Okay.
And that's, I think, a good place to begin a rough estimate of how often these things have to be replaced.
In your experience, is it every 3 years?
My experience is that there is no benchmark. I think that's a good thing. Often it's 1 year, often it's six. You know, these things are replaced for a variety of reasons. Most commonly, they're replaced for physiological changes to the individual, not for product defectiveness or anything of that nature. But the components themselves, I would say, have a lifespan of about 5 years. If we can keep a fit on somebody, if I can keep him from gaining 15 pounds for... If I could keep myself from gaining 15 pounds for 15, yeah, exactly. So it's normally physiological changes which require the changing of these prostheses, and I would say 3 is a fair average.
Okay. And one last question. I don't know if you'll know the answer to this, but what about our veterans? Are those, if they are injured, does the federal government pick up that cost? Or
that's a great question. As a resident, we obviously rotate through Dornbecker Children's Hospital, the Shrine, which is a whole other... system of dealing with prosthetic science, as well as the VA. I don't know that I have the data 100% correct. We actually do have a VA prosthetist here in the audience, but they do pay for them. They pay for them when they come back. They're covered to a very high degree. I've never had a VA amputee come to me saying he couldn't get a leg.
Yeah, but that's if it's service included.
Right.
I will tell you that commonly VAs, the veterans in this country, are putting themselves out on private insurance, although the VA has been, I will honestly say, historically very good about paying for prosthetics. Chair Greenlick, you had a question when we began about what's covered under this bill?
I have a question. I'll do it now. Specifically about the bill, which is not limited to amputees, as near as I can make out, and it's not limited to prosthesis, as near as I can make out.
Chairman Greenlick, we tried very hard to identify the definition of prosthetics associated with the Medicare definition of prosthetics and tie it to Medicare. And currently, under the Medicare DMOS fee schedule, there are not ancillary issues involved in this. The only eye prosthesis, et cetera, are not covered under their definition of prosthetics and under the fee schedule that we've tied this to. They're not part of that. Cosmetic restoration is not part of that. Eyes are not part of that. Breast prostheses are. Orthotics, in fact, are, but orthotics are also tied to this bill. Orthotics include places for people to utilize after spinal cord injuries, strokes, orthopedic surgeries. Those types of things are orthotics. Foot orthotics, as what you put in your shoes, are not covered under this particular piece of legislation, as it's not covered under Medicare. Or foot orthotics, as it relates to diabetic foot care, in fact, is covered by Medicare, but that's the only exception to that rule. And we could I could go as specific as you'd like on that.
No, we won't do it right now. Any other questions?
You may have answered this, and it's about the levels of prosthetics. I'm assuming you have the Chevy, the Lexus.
Yeah, I'm wearing the Ferrari.
Yeah, he's in the Ferrari, let's be clear. Medicare has defined guidelines. They've defined functional levels. They have 5 of them, 0 through 4. And in their guidelines, they specify whether you can have a Ferrari or a Chevy. But so if we continue to tie this to Medicare rules, we are not going to be seeing people in convalescent centers getting $30,000 legs. It just isn't going to happen.
Okay. Yes.
And Medicare's already taken care of that on our behalf.
Okay. Can you tell me where it says in the bill that it's under Medicare guidance? See where it says about the Medicare fee schedule.
We tried specifically to tie it, to create the definition specifically with Medicare guidelines. When it came through rewrite, it wasn't as specific. But under the fee schedule, as it currently set, these guidelines, these items are not included in the Medicare fee schedule, which you're discussing, under orthotics and prosthetics. They're just not in there. They're not part of that compensation. They're under durable medical equipment, sir, which is a slightly different definition of product than orthotics and prosthetics.
For some minutes, do you want?
I do. One last question.
Yeah, as many as you want.
Thank you. Could you tell me, I don't know if I asked this or if I missed it. If I did, forgive me. And if I missed the answer, I apologize. What does the tune-up usually cost if they have to replace a part? Not the whole leg, but if they have to replace a part, what is the average cost of that?
What is the average cost of man, that's a very difficult. A prosthetic foot can range in cost from $200 to as much as $4,500, depending on the technology involved in the product. The hard cost for replacing it is a couple hours of labor on part of the prosthetist. That remains stagnant at about $500 or $600 maybe. But the cost of the component piece itself depends on the technology of the piece that we're talking about. There are knee units out there, as a doctor will testify, that can cost as much as $30,000 or as little as $150, depending on what the need of the specific person is.
Can you give me an average?
Average foot, $750 to $1,100 for a foot, and that's a component cost. Average knee. I'm going to leave out the high-end microprocessors because it skews the averages, and not many people qualify for that. Average knee, $750 to $1,100 again, somewhere in that area. You leave out microprocessor, the top-end knee probably runs $3,500 in the unit itself.
It sounds rather than spending $30,000 on a leg, you ought to replace the part that it costs.
We make
$900.
We make every effort to do that as often as possible. Absolutely.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your testimony. I really appreciate it.
Since I stepped up, Chair Greenlee, what I wanted to share with Dr. Bradley, one of my favorite movies is Rudy, so I'll help write the screenplay for the Bradley story.
I'll send you a copy of the DVD.
Okay.
A little story on the side for that. Rudy is actually the real Rudy out of the movie. It was a janitor. At Notre Dame, was in charge of the stadium maintenance.
Right.
And every time we'd go to a football game, he stood at the front gates. We saw him many a time. So the kind of country down-home Rudy is still on campus.
Still.
And obviously, I've got a lot of pride in the
university. Yeah, it makes your heart sing.
It does. Thank you.
All right, last question.
Last question. And I think it is important, and your intent with this bill is not about opening up the world to the things that maybe drive costs out of the picture or make it unreasonable. But as I read you, your intent is to limit this to true need.
Absolutely. I think the California study I've given to you speaks to that very well, that there is really no real risk of increased utilization of technologies, inappropriate use of technologies, through tying reimbursement to Medicare, to the Medicare guidelines. So if that speaks to your question.
It does. And so what you're saying is that how if it's not currently tied directly, that would be a good thing to do, is to directly tie it. And I know the language may be.
I would go.
Is it your intention to limit this to amputees?
No, sir. This is an orthotic and prosthetic parity bill, which we had a couple people speak after the prosthetics. Orthotic and prosthetics, DMEPOS guidelines are grouped together as, and of course the facilities are orthotics and prosthetics. So this is for amputees and otherwise disabled people in need of highly customized, specialized assistive devices. We're not talking about off-the-shelf kind of stuff. We're talking about specific orthotic and prosthetic devices that return otherwise disabled individuals to active life.
You may not be talking about it, but the bill is talking to us.
The bill is speaking to orthotics and prosthetics. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Under open circumstances.
And Mr. Chairman, there's an interesting study that was done and looked at the cost of taking care of amputees by the insurance companies in the state of Massachusetts the year before getting parity passed and the year after. And if you just looked at the cost to the insurance companies, there was about $500,000, $440,000 savings just to the insurance companies for that year after parity is passed. So it actually ended up saving the insurance company's money, even though it cost them money for the prosthetics. And where the savings was in these patients were not falling on crutches and breaking their wrist or breaking the hip. hips, which meant hundreds of thousands of dollars of hospital costs.
That study's about amputees.
No,
this
sir.
Bill is not about amputees.
These studies are, in fact, orthotic and prosthetic parity bills.
Exactly.
Not just prosthetic parity bills. And it's a fair point, because we end up speaking more towards the prosthetics. I understand that.
Let's move on to the next group.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for testifying. Well, we have our old friend Dr. Lace with us today.
Thanks, sir.
As usual. John Powell, Lisa Trussell. You guys all join us. You get the assignment because you live in Salem, I think. Is that right, Jim?
I guess that's why.
My assumption is there's nobody else that signed up to testify. Oh, yeah, we may get Mr. Ariel today.
Oh, you're all going to be here. I'll jump in.
Okay.
Another old friend's trying to slip in here. How come you brought him along, John?
Mr. Chairman, sometimes you have no choice.
Okay, what order do we want? Dr. Lace, you want to start?
Okay, for the record, my name is Dr. Lace. I'm a pediatrician here in Salem. I represent the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society. We're here to testify in favor of House Bill 2517. You've heard the arguments, you've heard the discussion to this point. There was one gentleman who had to leave early who's actually the DME coordinator for prosthetics and orthotics for our local MCHIPS, which is our OHP contractor here in Marion Polk County. And his testimony has been submitted. We're here to support this, and we like the goal of trying to restore people to their full function whenever possible. The OMA traditionally has not gone after insurance mandates. We could put out a bazillion things that we'd like to have covered, but there's some things that seem to come in that if their insurance companies, for whatever reason, don't seem to be addressing those properly, that seem to rise up, that seem to warrant our support. So we're here to be here in support of that. And after listening to Dr. Bradley, I'd just like to say personally, it's hard to find a doctor, you know, like him, who really goes beyond, you know, what most of us do and really gets into it for the patient, fights, you know, is a real strong patient advocate. So we support that. We've heard him, we had discussions with him in our executive committee, in our legislative committee, and we think that this is a worthwhile, you know, thing to look at and examine. Just make sure that we're careful. We're not trying to sink the insurance companies. We just want to make sure it's done carefully and it's done with view to cost and make sure that it's a cost-effective intervention.
Are there any questions of Dr. Lace? Okay. Who's next?
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Mr. Chairman, I think Dr. Bradley will be less saddened by my testimony than he was the last time Notre Dame met Oregon State on a football field.
Or Michigan either, John.
Mr. Chairman and members, at Regents, we're proud of the way we have administered the benefit portion of our policy that deals particularly with amputees. And we understand that there are differences in policies from carrier to carrier. So we will be pleased to work with you and this committee on trying to perfect a measure such as this. However, we do agree that this bill has some very significant definitional and wording problems, and including the fee setting and the deductible and coinsurance setting provisions by the insurance division. And they can speak to themselves to that, but we do believe that part of it's inappropriate. So I don't want to go into the detail of the bill given the hour. But we do believe that it needs to be tightened with definitional standards, and we do have concerns about the high end, and beyond what is here in the marketplace today. In fact, I've ordered through a service a clip from Good Morning America or one of those shows on Monday of this week, and I have not received it yet. But there was a discussion over the ethics of a computer device that could read the mind and control a limb. So this field is exploding, and that's why we're interested in working with the people who brought this bill forward and you over the terminology and design of the benefit.
Could you briefly tell us how Blue Cross handles these issues right now in your sort of standard group plan?
Mr. Chairman, there are two or three different benefit plans, but they rely most heavily on medical necessity and the individual and the individual's needs, and trying to match those two together. As was presented here, some people are more active than others, and certain devices are more appropriate for others. And the goal is to match the appropriate device to that person. And so that's the thrust of how that benefit is administered. My policy does not have a cap on it for this device. I didn't know that until I read this bill. I went to it to look because I assumed that there probably would be a cap. But the key is, if I need a device like this, can I just go order, say, I want the top of the line, when in fact that may not be what fits my life, needed for my lifestyle and what I do.
Thank you, Mr. Niebuhr.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ed Niebuhr. I'm the Director of Regulatory Affairs for Providence Health Plan. I'm here to speak in opposition to the bill as currently drafted, but as John stated, we would be supportive. We would hope we could be supportive of a refinement of the bill that we thought made better sense of some of the definitions and struck an appropriate balance. I would just like to hit a few of the issues that raise concerns with us. We've talked a little about, gee, this is a benefit mandate bill, and it is, and it's similar in some ways to many mandates that the legislature has seen and sometimes enacted. But this one is fundamentally different in one way that I think makes a fundamental difference that needs to be considered. This is really a four-part mandate. The first part of this mandate is what I'd call a mandate for covered devices. We have some concern about the definition of those covered devices. We think the definition of prosthetics and orthotics in this bill is very wide. I did the classic Google search, and I came up with much more limited definitions of prosthetics than devices than this bill seems to encompass. So I think we do need to address that. I mean, I'll tell you, the most common orthotic that we deal with, common in terms of volume, not dollars, are shoe inserts. I heard the gentleman say this bill wouldn't cover that, but I don't see that in the bill.
Actually, I think eyeglasses are the most common that you cover under this definition.
Oh, that could be. That could be. Someone said when I brought my hat up to the table, I ought not to refer to it as an orthotic, and I think we could agree to that. So we would agree that the definitions do need improvement in this bill. Secondly, this is a mandate for covered providers. But covered providers in a particular circumstance. Mandates are not unusual in this state to address certain covered providers, acupuncturists, for instance. But this is a mandate that says covered providers in an otherwise closed network managed care plan, covered providers have to be allowed outside of the network plan. We don't see any evidence that that's a problem in this state, that managed care plans aren't providing access to appropriate providers, but this bill would say you have to open up your network if you're a managed care plan. The third aspect of this mandate is it's a mandated for regulated benefit payments, and that's also quite unusual. Typically, a mandate in this state that's enacted says you shall cover a service, an item, and cover it like you cover other medical services. In fact, this bill says that in one paragraph, cover it like other services. And then it goes on to say, but pay for it according to a schedule that is somehow, we're not quite clear, somehow a combination of Medicare and what the insurance division comes up with. We think that's very unusual and ill-advised, and we again would support an approach that says if you've got a covered service, cover it like the rest of your medical services. I heard the phrase parity. We all know that this state enacted mental health parity recently, and that is the key principle of parity. You cover mental health like you cover other medical services, no better, no worse, no dictated, regulated fee schedule. And so we think that that would be a good principle to apply here, too. And the last piece of this is it's a mandate for repair and replacement according to the preferences of the treating practitioner, as opposed to what we would refer to, again, as medical necessity. And again, if we look at mental health parity, it says the frequency of mental health services shall be in parity with medical services. That's a medical necessity standard. It's not an arbitrary standard that says, gee, whatever your treating practitioner wants, that's what you get. So those are the issues that we think need closer attention. We think there's sort of a core principle here that we could agree on, but we think the details have departed from the core principle. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell, and I represent the members of Associated Oregon Industries. And I just wanted to come on the record to voice our concerns about the bill. I'm sure that most of you, with the exception perhaps of Representative Cannon and Representative Maurer, have heard AOI's position on mandates before. And
it's somebody's phone. It's the BlackBerry's or a phone.
Oh, okay.
It's not me.
Okay. Our concern is that every time a mandate, no matter how well-intended, is implemented, somebody loses insurance coverage because the cost share of their policy goes up and people lose insurance coverage. So some people gain a benefit,
Evidence? I'd be interested in the study of that. Do you have any evidence about that? That say 15 cents a member month?
The last one, Mr. Chair, that I have been aware of, and that number has changed, was approximately in the 03 session where 1% was 3,000 lives. But I think that during the recession, we had a number of people lose insurance, and so 1% is a much smaller number now than it was previously.
But it would be very interesting. I mean, we're talking about, I don't know the number, but maybe 25 cents a member per month.
And I don't know it that way.
That would cause people to lose coverage, you think?
If you could convert it to the percentage of premium, you can identify that.
The minimus percentage.
Yeah. So, but along with that is the concerns that they've both outlined here, Mr. Powell and Mr. Niebert, particularly sections 4, 5, 6, and 8, having a division. And we would hope that if the bill's going forward, that some of those concerns are addressed. And thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions in this panel?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Could I address one thing?
Of course.
Thank you.
Yeah, the microphone, we can't take it away.
The phenomenon of the growth in the uninsured is a difficult one to quantify, and there have been some studies of how many people drop off, national studies, how many people lose coverage for every percentage increase in the coverage. And the problem I think that Ms. Trussell was pointing out is that these things are added to other inflationary factors, so it's not like that's all the increase a worker's going to have to pay for their dependents next year, and there's utilization increases and other inflationary increases in the policy costs.
I understand. The notion is if you have a 5% increase next year, that may be $40 a week, and that might cost $40 a month, and that might cause somebody to drop out. If you make that $42 a month, I'd be interested if there's any evidence that that might make any difference.
And Mr. Chairman, there's only slight evidence in the last couple of years due to
kind of the leveling off of the increase in insurance premiums. The report from the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research this year does indicate that there's a slight reduction in the insured population for adults and children. So it does kind of indicate that coverage is price sensitive and that we've had this kind of mellowing of the cost for a short period of time, and it seems to be bearing out in the results of the uninsured population.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have one more witness to call. I think we do.
Oh, yeah, Joe Laria. Representative Buckley, you going to hang around for a bit?
Yes, sir.
Dr. Bradley, you going to hang around for a bit?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Laria. I'm the insurance administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'll be very brief. I want to start, though, by noting that I do think Ed's hat is an orthotic. I mean, having seen him for a number of years.
We bald people understand that.
The department has no position on the bill. We do have a technical comment. It was referred to by some of the previous people who testified. The requirement in here that we set the copays is an unusual one. We don't have that authority with other copays. In concept, we wouldn't necessarily be opposed to having that authority. You know, it would be a precedent-setting sort of thing. But if we were to have it, we would advise that we be given some direction on what the legislative intent is in terms of how to set that. All it says here is can be higher than some standard, but doesn't tell us anything about what principles we should use if we were going to lower below that standard. So if you want us to get into this business, which some other people probably don't, but if you do, we would at least like some legislative guidance on how to exercise that discretion. And that's all I have to say.
We promise. If we hand that over to you, we'll tell you what we want you to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are there any other questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Ross. It sounds to me like we have the possibility of perfecting this into a bill that can get some consensus on it. It's your bill, Representative Buckley. Would you like to work with the parties and see if you can?
I'd be happy to do so.
That'd be great, and make sure Dr. Bradley, if he's not babysitting, can be involved in that, if you will.
I'd love the family.
It's great to see the kids in this kind of hearing. I love it. Okay, Madam Administrator.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just so you know, you were just passed.
Let me close the hearing. No, you want me not to close the hearing.
Right. This is for the record.
All right.
You were just passed out some written testimony submitted by Tim Weld, who is the coordinator of the Mid-Valley IPA, and he is the prosthetic and orthotic coordinator. He could not testify, but he wanted to submit his testimony for the record. And I believe you all received via email an email from Stephen R. Childs that we would like to acknowledge for the record also. If you did not get that email, let me know and I will give you a photocopy of my email. But I've polled a couple of you and you've acknowledged you've gotten it. And that's all the business I have, Mr.
My
Chair.
Staff doesn't always let me see email that's not from a constituent, so I'm not sure whether I got it or I didn't.
Oh, your staff.
Yeah.
Okay. Not me.
No, not you. We will close the hearing on HB 2517. Those of us that want to join the Senate Select Committee on Health Reform, it's going to be down in hearing room 50 downstairs, taking it back to the glory days of Senator Bates and Westland, and adjourn the meeting.